Slide 5 has to do with light, which of course is essential to photosynthesis. Without light, there is no photosynthesis. But let's talk about what light is for a little bit. It is energy, but specifically light is an example of electromagnetic energy or electromagnetic radiation, so-called because there's an electrical component and a magnetic component. We're not going to get into the physics of that. But electromagnetic radiation can exist in a very wide spectrum of wavelengths. Electromagnetic radiation is, well, it has a duality of nature, which is also beyond the scope of this course. But what I mean by that is that light, in some ways, acts like a wave, and in some other ways, acts like a particle, even though it's a particle that doesn't have any mass. Well, the particle, when we consider it to be particles, those particles are called photons. But it also has wave-like properties, like I said. Well, anything that has a is in waves has what are called wavelengths, which, as the name implies, is a distance. It's just the distance between corresponding parts of the wave pattern. So you could measure it, for instance, from peak to peak, or from trough to trough, or from anywhere to the next corresponding part. It'll always be the same distance. That's the wavelength. And so there's all kinds of different, so-called different categories of light listed here at the top. It's all the same stuff. The only difference between these categories is the wavelength. And the shorter the wavelength, which would be like this, the higher the frequency, the longer the wavelength, the lower the frequency, but also the shorter the wavelength, the more energetic that electromagnetic energy is. Well, you see the entire range here from very, very short wavelengths, a tiny fraction of a nanometer on the left, all the way down to many meters, 1,000 meters on the right. That's all the same stuff, but only a little sliver of it right here in the middle, roughly from 400 to 750 nanometers in wavelength, is what we usually call light. It's really all light, but humanly visible light is what we usually mean when we refer to that. It's no different from radio waves or microwaves. It's just that only this little fraction of the overall spectrum of wavelengths happen to interact with molecules in our eyes' retinas, which eventually leads to the sensation of vision. So the rest of the stuff is invisible to us, but it's not fundamentally different. It's just invisible either because it's too short a wavelength or too long a wavelength. Well, I said that shorter the wavelength, the more the energy, and therefore the shorter wavelength invisible light gets more and more dangerous the shorter the wavelength gets. So we can see visible light as the spectrum that's often abbreviated as Roy G. Biv. You've probably learned that, right? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Well, you might be thinking red is associated with fire, blue is associated with coolness, but it's the blue end of the visible spectrum that is actually the most energetic of the visible light. The red end is longer wavelength. If you get shorter than the shortest wavelength we can see, which is violet, then that's why it's called ultraviolet. And already that stuff gets dangerous, right? Ultraviolet radiation in sunlight causes skin cancer if you get too much of it. Get it even shorter, you're into X-rays, which are even more dangerous, which is why you have to limit how much you get at a doctor's office, for instance. And then beyond that, even shorter, it's gamma rays, which are really dangerous, but thankfully those get filtered out. They don't really reach the Earth, or we would be dying all the time. Well, once each person. Longer than red, longer wavelengths than visible for humans is infrared, below red. Even longer still are microwaves that are used for cooking food, but also that's how your cell phones operate. even longer than that, radio waves. All of this stuff is continuously going through our bodies, these long wave categories, microwaves and radio waves. We just don't have any way of detecting it because they don't interact with the molecules of our body. Well, this is a chapter on photosynthesis, not on human vision. So why do we care about the humanly visible portion? Well, it's just by coincidence, really. The pigments in our eyes operate similarly to the pigments in photosynthetic organisms by absorbing photons of about the same range. So this humanly visible portion is also the portion of the spectrum that is important for photosynthetic organisms. That's the kind of light that they absorb to give them the energy to perform photosynthesis. Now let's look at the anatomy of a... Well, I'm sorry, this isn't about the anatomy. This is showing you light striking a chloroplast. And I mentioned this, I think, in an earlier lecture, but when a photon, which is a little packet of light energy, encounters an object, I was talking about this in the spectrophotometry lab, there's three major possibilities. One is that it just passes through it. That's called transmission. Transmitted light shown here just goes all the way through it. A second is that it bounces off in some other direction. It reflects, in other words. Neither of those would do a plant any good because the photon doesn't get absorbed in either of those cases. It just gets redirected. But the third possibility is that the photon gets absorbed by that particle. And we call particles that are able to absorb photons in the humanly visible range pigments. That's why pigments in art are colorful, or they look colorful to us, because they absorb some of the photons. Now, when we say something has color, that's really a lie. Color is not a property of the thing that you're looking at. Nothing has color, really. Color is a human perception. It's an event occurring in the brain. It is a particular set of electrical activity happening in the neurons of your brain in response to you looking at something. But the plant, we say it all the time, looks green. It's not actually green. The reason it looks green is that white light gets shown on the plant. White, remember, is the combination of all colors. So there's combination of all wavelengths. That's all colors to us. That's striking the plant. Some of the energy gets absorbed. Well, specifically, it's wavelengths in the blue range and the red range, the edges of our perception, that get absorbed well by the plants. So when a photon gets absorbed by a particle, the photon no longer exists. The energy gets transferred to the thing absorbing the photons. That's how plants get the energy for photosynthesis. Green, on the other hand, the wavelength corresponding to greenness in us, does not get absorbed very well by plants. So that instead gets reflected, and so instead of getting all the colors or all the wavelengths to our eyes, which would give us the sensation of whiteness, we're given the sensation of greenness because only the ones with those wavelengths reach our eyes from the plants. The greenness is an event in our head, though, not a part of the plant. All right, now we can see this in slide 7 in a little bit different ways. The graph at the top is actually three graphs in one because there's three different traces, but if you just look at one trace, that graph would be called an absorption spectrum. Spectra is just the plural of spectrum because there's really three different graphs here. But an absorption spectrum graphs how well something absorbs versus the wavelength of the light, which corresponds to color to us. All right, and what you see here is that there are three different kinds of pigments being simultaneously graphed here. Plants don't use just one pigment. Chlorophyll is the major, that's the principal photosynthetic pigment. But as you see here, there's two major versions of chlorophyll, chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B, so they're actually distinct pigments. And then there's also other pigments that plants use besides chlorophyll, which collectively are called accessory pigments, and the chief accessory pigments are carotenoids. They're all being graphed here, though, but each individual pigment type, notice, has its own shape, and the shape is such that there are peaks at certain parts corresponding to certain wavelengths and low parts for others. So an absorption spectrum tells you the specific wavelengths or colors of light that a given pigment absorb well. The higher the Y value, the better they're doing. Well, you can see here that none of these major pigments that plants use absorb very well in the green range, which is why they look green to us. That green light gets sent to our eyes. Everything else gets absorbed by the plant. By the way, this is why you should never give a plant nothing but green light. You would starve it, right? If you're growing dope in your closet, which you don't have to do now that it's legal, you don't want to give it purely green light. It would just not be able to absorb it, and therefore it would not be able to feed itself. Okay. The middle one is an action spectrum, which corresponds to the overall shape of the absorption spectrum, but an action spectrum actually measures the rate of photosynthesis versus wavelength, and you can see what I was just telling you. If you give a plant green light, it can't perform photosynthesis, which is why it would starve it eventually. And the bottom one is yet another way of looking at the same thing. Here, they used a glass slide in a vacuum on which they put an alga, a filamentous alga, which has multiple cells, but they're end-to-end, kind of like a tapeworm. And an alga is a photosynthetic organism. Then they put light through a prism so that each cell is getting only a certain color. What they measured were aerobic bacteria. These are bacteria that require oxygen to live. That's why they're aerobic. And notice that they do well. The bacteria are clumping here and here at the ends. And that's because when you give these algal cells red or blue light, they perform photosynthesis, and a byproduct of that is O2, which allows the bacteria to live. But here where they're getting green light, there's no photosynthesis and no O2 being produced, so the bacteria can't grow in those conditions. Right. We're seeing red for the same reason, a similar reason, namely that the other colors get absorbed and red gets reflected. But the reason, importantly, the redness, the petal, is not performing photosynthesis. That's there just to attract animals to it, to pollinate it. Only the green parts of plants are capable of photosynthesis. Yeah. They measured the buildup of the bacteria. And the more the bacteria built up, the more that indicated that that region had O2 available for them to exist. And that O2, since it was in a vacuum, that O2 had to come from the algal cells themselves, from photosynthesis. Okay, let's take an even closer look at chlorophyll now. I don't expect you to memorize this structure. It's a complex structure, as you see, but actually this is either kind of the two major kinds of chlorophyll, A and B. It just depends on what is in the little box up there. If it's CH3, as it is right there, then you have chlorophyll A. Chlorophyll B is everything else is the same except that little box has CHO instead of CH3. That little bit is enough to make a difference, though, in which specific wavelengths they absorb best. They have different absorption spectra. But a plant has both kinds in it. Now, In terms of being a pigment, which means by definition absorbing photons, that's the important thing for photosynthesis, of course. In those terms, the business end of this molecule, the part that does the absorption of photons, is the part highlighted in green. And that's the part that makes it look green to us. But there's a lot more of the molecule that's outside of that green range, which is also important. It's just not the part that absorbs the photons. Now, you have in this top part a bunch of explicitly listed atoms, right? C's, N's, O's, H's. So you know what's there. But look at this one. There's no letters on this, which is really just biochemical shorthand. In biochemistry, you're so often dealing with hydrocarbons and organic compounds in general, with a bunch of carbons and hydrogens, that they eventually got sick of writing C's and H's all the time. So whenever you have just shapes like this, every bend, every corner, if it's not explicitly listed as some other symbol like an O, then you have to assume that's a C. Every bend or every end of a line. So there are C's all these places, really, even though they're not listed. And then you also have to, by knowledge of valence, fill in as many H's as are necessary. So really here you have a C, and a C. This C is only making two bonds here, so you have to have two hydrogens as well. You see what I'm saying? The point here is, though, when you see no letters, then what category of molecules would you describe this as? Or this part of it, at least. A hydrocarbon, as it's listed here. This is a hydrocarbon tail. Now, not the whole chlorophyll molecule. Technically, it's not a hydrocarbon. But just this part of it would be described as a hydrocarbon tail. And where else do you see hydrocarbon tails that we've talked about? Phospholipids and fats, right? Fatty acids, in general, are really just a carboxyl group with a hydrocarbon tail. Phospholipids, though, have those tails as the hydrophobic part of the phospholipid bilayer in any membrane. And that's the importance of this hydrocarbon tail in a chlorophyll molecule. This is what allows it to be embedded in the membrane, not the plasma membrane. The thylakoid membrane of a chloroplast. All right? So the millions and millions of chlorophyll and other pigment molecules that are important for photosynthesis are part of the thylakoid membrane in the chloroplast. They are therefore membrane-bound particles, these pigments. All right? This anchors them in the plasma membrane because they have no problem being around the other equally hydrophobic hydrocarbon tails of the phospholipids. Okay. Now to 9. I want you to think back about the discussion of energy levels when we first started talking about subatomic particles. Energy levels are occupied by electrons, right? And the lowest energy level in any given atom is closest to the nucleus. Electrons would like to occupy the lowest energy level, but some atoms have more electrons than the energy level can handle, right? Can only hold so many. So in general, electrons occupy the lowest energy level that's available to them in an atom. That's the most stable situation. What we have here is what's called excitation. If a this is a pigment molecule, which includes not just chlorophyll, any pigment molecule. But when a pigment molecule, by definition, can absorb a photon of some wavelength. So a photon comes along and gets absorbed. Like I told you before, that means it no longer exists. The energy that it was carrying, of course, does still exist because no energy is created or destroyed. First law of thermodynamics. Therefore, while the photon is destroyed, the energy is put into the photon in the form of an excited electron. The photon being absorbed excites an electron of that pigment molecule. And what that means is that the electron moves up at least one, or maybe more than one, energy level. That's an excited electron. Okay? Well, when it moves up an energy level, that means that electron has more energy than it did at the lower energy level. Stands to reason. But, like I told you a minute ago, electrons want to occupy the lowest energy level available. So, while they get excited and go up an energy level, they want to immediately come back down. And so they will. When they come back down, that's a decrease in energy, just like it is when electrons get transferred along an electron transport chain, by the way. They're getting lower and lower energy level, so there's energy released. It's not destroyed once again. The energy is released. So when the excited electron comes back down to where it was before it was excited, a brand new photon gets created to carry that energy away from the molecule. So there's no creation or destruction of energy. It just was originally in the first photon, then it was in the form of an excited electron, and then it's in the form of a brand new photon that gets shown away from the pigment. In other words, the photon lights up. I mean, the pigment lights up. This is called fluorescence. And I guess I didn't have to write that. It was already written. Fluorescence is creation of light. So if you think about fluorescent paint, for instance, it looks very bright, right? It is very bright, but not because it's just reflecting a lot of light to our eyes. It's actually fluorescing. It is creating its own light, like an electric lamp would. Only it's doing that in response to light that you shine on it that excites the electrons. Then the electrons drop back down and create brand new photons that get put to your eyes. You see this, for instance, you know, if you drive out in the middle of nowhere, way out of the city at night, where the only light is your headlights, the speed limit signs look really bright, but only while your headlights are shining on them, because they're actually creating their own light. Well, fluorescence would be exactly the opposite of what a plant wants, because a plant wants to capture the energy of sunlight, right? Fluorescence doesn't capture that energy. Fluorescence just shines it away as brand new photons. So none of that energy would be captured by a photosynthetic organism if the chlorophyll and other pigment molecules were allowed to fluoresce. But if you have just isolated pigment molecules, chlorophyll molecules in solution, so they're not part of an organism, nothing living here, it's just a beaker, an Erlenmeyer flask in this case, full of chlorophyll molecules, then they will fluoresce. You know, you shine the light on them, they will light up with their own light. That would do the plant no good, though. So in an organism, the chlorophyll molecules do not fluoresce. They're kept from fluorescing because of how they are arranged with special proteins in the plant. They're not just pigment molecules on their own, in other words. Well, we can see this special arrangement of pigment and proteins in slide 10. So this membrane, first of all, is not the plasma membrane. This is just a tiny slice of the thylakoid membrane, which is in those figures, all the green stuff, in one chloroplast. And what looks like a cutaway view of a bell pepper is one photosystem. This is called a photosystem. A photosystem is a complex arrangement of proteins and pigment molecules. And This is a cutaway view, so you would normally see purple all the way around, but it's been cut away so that we can see this bluish or lavender interior. There's two parts to any given photo system. One part, this bluish part, is the reaction center complex, as you see labeled there. And then surrounding that reaction center complex are several different light harvesting complexes. And in those light harvesting complexes, which are protein complexes, there's millions of pigment molecules. We just show you some of them. The green dots represent pigment molecules. Well, I said that fluorescence is disallowed in a plant because it would be wasteful. I can't get into exactly how this occurs because it's beyond the scope of this course. But I can tell you the name of how it happens. In a plant, energy of excitation gets transferred from one pigment molecule to the next without producing any photons, without fluorescence, by a mechanism called resonance energy transfer. So for this course, don't worry how this happens, but it does happen. What we see happening here is that a photon comes in from sunlight or artificial light, and, you know, a beam of light is quadrillions and quadrillions of photons, most of which do not happen to excite an electron of a pigment. Most of them will just hit a piece of the plant that is not a pigment. So a lot of the sunlight coming in gets wasted as far as photosynthesis is concerned. But still, trillions and trillions of photons do just by chance hit a photon. It hit a pigment molecule. Doesn't have to be this one in the upper left. It could be any one of them. But that whatever pigment molecule that gets hit by a photon, that's a pigment molecule that gets directly excited, like I described. Now, normally it would fluoresce, but because of the way that it is arranged with these protons in a photosystem, instead of fluorescing, it will transfer the energy of its excitation to a nearby pigment molecule by resonance energy transfer. So this second one after the black arrow, this second pigment molecule also gets excited, but not because it was hit by a photon. Instead, it's excited because the excitation gets sent to it from the one that was stricken by the photon. And so, energy of excitation gets transferred from pigment molecule to pigment molecule until eventually the excitation gets transferred to a special pair of chlorophylls that are in the reaction center complex. That's this part right here. All right? What's important about that is that this special pair of chlorophylls, when they get excited, they really get excited. Meaning that not only does the electron go up an energy level, it totally leaves the molecule. That's what this orangish arrow represents with the E minus, which is an electron. So instead of just exciting it, it ionizes it, right? It's losing an electron. Well, the electron doesn't get destroyed, of course. It has to go somewhere. And where it goes, represented by this blue box, is part of the reaction center complex called the primary electron acceptor. Pretty well named, because that's what it does. It accepts the electron that's removed from the reaction center chlorophyll. Yeah. Well, yes, there's always energy lost, but very, very small amount. Okay, so we have the energy, we have the electron being sent to the primary electron acceptor. Chemically speaking, how would you describe what's happening to the primary electron acceptor? It's becoming reduced, exactly. And this is how photosystems operate. They transduce or convert light energy, which is radiant energy, electromagnetic energy, into the energy of a reduced particle. And compare this to the previous chapter. The energy that was in fuel, glucose originally, gets put temporarily into the form of a reduced particle, right? NADH is carrying that energy when it gets reduced. Similarly here. So this is the capturing aspect of photosynthesis, where the light actually gets captured and put into the form of reduced particles. That, in general, is a photosystem. And I think I'm going to stop there and resume on 11 when we're upstairs later. All right.